KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to KSL at Night. This is Taylor Morgan, your host for this evening. Listeners, I want to make sure you know that anytime you are looking for a prior recorded show that was aired here on KSL News Radio, if it's Boyd Matheson's Inside Sources or Dave Noriega and Debbie Dujanovic on Dave and Dujanovic in the mornings, or KSL at Night, you can find any and every prior recorded show in podcast format on kslpodcast.com after the show has been aired. It's a great resource, a lot of content there. Put in your earbuds, do the housework, put it on in the car on your way to work. You can find everything at kslpodcast.com. With that said, let's get into our first topic tonight, the race to fill the upcoming vacancy that will be left by the retirement of Utah Senator Mitt Romney. The race for the Republican nomination to fill the U.S. Senate seat is heating up. The first real decision point will be on Saturday, April 27th, the state Republican Party convention. And going into convention, the race is getting a little bit dirty with some new attack ads coming from shady super PACs and other sources. We want to talk about this with the one and only Holly Richardson, editor of Utah Policy. Holly, welcome to the show. I'm sorry to bring you on to talk about this this dirty campaigning story, but you have a lot of experience with positive campaigning. You have a really good sense of what's happening behind the scenes in Utah politics. So can you walk our listeners through what the latest examples are of dirty campaigning in Utah?
You bet. So negative campaigning is one of my favorite topics.
Okay. Way to keep it positive, Holly. I love it.
One of the reasons is it happens every single cycle. And the reason it does is because they work. So there's some hope, right, that voters start to become more and more aware of these kind of attack ads. So what we mean by shadowy PACs, a political action committee, sending out text messages and emails to delegates right now, what that looks like is an anonymous PAC. They have this innocuous sounding name. They didn't start spending money until right after the March 31st filing deadline. So nobody knows where their money came from. And they won't have to file another report until after the convention has happened. So that's kind of the shadow part, right? You don't know where they're coming from. You don't know who's funding them. But there's a PAC, at least one, that is sending out emails and text messages attacking at least two candidates in the race for Senate, John Curtis and Trent Staggs. And they're attacking these two candidates for not being supportive enough of President Donald Trump.
This is so interesting to me, Holly, because yes, Trent Staggs he did endorse Ron DeSantis early on in the Republican primary or nomination process for president, but so did everybody else, Holly. Trent seems be probably the most credible MAGA candidate in the U.S. Senate race. So why are they going after Trent Staggs?
Well, the clear answer is because they have another candidate that they prefer. So we don't know, we can't know for sure, is it another Republican candidate? I mean, that's the assumption.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, you'll see in other races nationally where you've got the other party that attacks the stronger candidate so they can get a weaker candidate to win the primary.
Right.
And then their candidate can win in the general. I don't think that's the case in Utah, but you just have to look at it and say, okay, who benefits from having John Curtis and Trent Staggs lose votes?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, Holly. And going into convention on Saturday, we know that out of convention, there will emerge likely a Republican convention nominee if any one candidate gets 60% or more of the vote at convention. With so many candidates in the race, I can't decide if I think it's likely that we'll have one 60% plus come out of convention or if we're going to split and have two convention nominees come out of convention. But regardless, we have at least three candidates who have qualified for a primary with signatures. So, Holly, this is just the tip of the iceberg, the very beginning of what could become a very nasty Senate race.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what happens, right? And one of the things that I find amusing, and I'm sure that the people who are the targets of these ads don't find amusing, but if you're getting an attack ad and it looks like a shadowy picture, they've overlaid, like it's a black and white picture where the candidate looks angry, you can be sure that that's an attack ad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they take a kernel of truth, like the Ron DeSantis thing, and then they blow it up into something that it's not really. So that's one of the things that's frustrating, right, is most of what happens is a lie, but they'll say, okay, well, there was this one time where this candidate said this thing.
Yeah.
Look, I was a victim of negative advertising or negative campaigning when I was a delegate when I was a candidate in the delegate process.
Yeah.
And there was an anonymous letter sent out. They created a fake logo and a fake letterhead and said, you know, Holly and this other candidate, we just have to tell you, they're just not good people. And nobody likes Holly, by the way. That was their attack. Nobody likes Holly. Well,
and that's like the one thing that you can't attack Holly Richardson for, because I don't know anyone who doesn't like Holly.
Well, there's plenty, but in any case, right, what happened is I didn't win. It did impact the person that they were hoping would win, and they won. And then the day after convention, the same anonymous source sent to all the delegates a letter of apology saying, oh, my bad, I was wrong, sorry.
Oh. Okay, well, I have to ask this question, Holly, and I'm not trying to lead the witness here, I promise. We have a couple minutes left. I want to disclose and be transparent about my bias. I currently serve as executive director of Count My Vote. This is the group that implemented the signature path to the primary ballot to bypass caucus convention. So I have a bias here. But let me ask this. Do you think negative campaigning has more sway among delegates or more sway among general Republican voters in a primary? I'm not leading you because I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I'm curious as to how you see it.
I actually think it has more sway among regular primary voters.
Okay.
And here's why. So the delegate pool is relatively small. So there's 4,000 GOP delegates for state races. So you've got 4,000 people that are being targeted by these negative messages. It's not that hard for those delegates to reach out to, you know, John Curtis's campaign or Trent Stagg's campaign and say, hey, tell me about this.
Yeah.
And for those campaigns to respond, right? These attacks are coming early enough. It's easy for these campaigns to respond. And they, quote unquote, only have to get to 4,000 voters. In a broader primary, it's harder, especially if the attacks come right before Election Day.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that is a fair point, Holly. I will say that even though I've been very critical of delegates and their ability to vet candidates in the past, I was a county delegate for Salt Lake County, and I attended a number of town halls, and I came away rethinking my opinion. I was very impressed with the aptitude, with the acumen, and the sincerity of the delegates I interacted with. And so I guess my hope would be that I hope our state delegates in the Republican Party are above this kind of dirty tactics. So,
I hope so too.
We'll watch it closely. I'm sure we'll have you back soon as it develops. Holly Richardson, editor at Utah Policy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, coming up next, we will be joined by Congressman John Curtis to talk about his work challenging a new BLM rule that could undermine Utah's ability to manage their own public lands. Stay right here. That's after the break.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL at night. This is your host, Taylor Morgan. I am very pleased to be joined now for this segment by Congressman John Curtis, who is with us to talk about his challenge to the BLM rule and his work to defend lands for Utahns. Representative, thank you so much for joining us here on KSL at night. And tell us about your work here challenging this BLM rule that just came out that drastically changes the way public lands are managed here in the state. Tell us what you're doing.
Yeah, Taylor, thank you for this opportunity. It is a big deal. And As listeners probably know, Utah is made up of, I think it's 67% federal lands. Much of my district, it's over 90%. So in short, this allows a large swath of Utah to be controlled by a government entity with zero accountability, meaning the BLM can issue these conservation areas, and there's no elected official involved in it. There's no process involved in it. It gives them the unilateral ability to do this. It's the equivalent of a president using the Antiquities Act, which is, you know, Utah knows has been used, you know, in some really difficult ways for us over the years, but by a government agency, not by the president.
Yeah, definitely. This is certainly something that is obviously key to the entire state, but particularly the district that you represent in Congress has such a high percentage of public lands, of BLM administered lands. Last year, I recall you introduced the West Act. Can you tell us a little bit about that and tie in some of the historical work that you have done for Utah's public lands to this current ruling?
Yeah, before I go to the West, I'm going to actually deal with that, the part of your question, because I think it's really critical that people realize when we push back in Utah, we're not pushing back against somehow we want to destroy these lands. We're not pushing back that we don't want to take care of them. The pushback is that we want to be in charge, right?
Yeah,
we think that those closest to the land know best how to preserve and take care of it. And by the way, we think we've done an amazing job over the decades.
Yeah.
So I do want to clarify that, because sometimes the rhetoric is, well, you just want to somehow, you know, destroy these lands. And just look at the, you know, the record and the history, and you'll see we've done an amazing job of preserving and protecting these lands. The West Act basically, it repeals this BLM rule and doesn't let them put it into place, which, as we just talked about, gives them this unilateral authority to declare these conservation areas. It would take that authority away from them. We've passed that bill through the House Natural Resources Committee. It'll go to the floor for a vote very quickly. I believe it'll pass the House. Then our challenge becomes getting it through the Democratic Senate. And we may need to be a little patient on it until we can change, you know, the makeup of the Senate and the presidency, but we've got to move on this, and we can't just take this lying down.
Congressman, I want to stay on this point that you brought up, that, you know, our work, your fighting, and Utah's fight on public lands is not just about trying to extract minerals. It's not about, you know, just trying to extract resources or mining or those kinds of things. It really is about who has a say in managing the lands, the local stakeholders or bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. And this is a fight that has been going on, you know, for decades. And we know how valuable our public lands here in Utah are to our economy, not just for the many resources in the land, but also for the variety and access to outdoor recreation that makes our state and our economy really the best and strongest economy in the country. So it's a variety of uses. What is the political, I guess, state of play when it comes to public lands? Is it just state versus federal? Is it a Republican state versus a Democratic White House? Or how do we move beyond just this partisan fight over our lands?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm really pleased. We have been able to put forward some really impressive legislation. I'll point out the Emory County Public Lands Bill that designated, I think it was about 1.3 million acres where we would recreate, where we would graze, where we would extract, and where we would protect. And nobody should be surprised that the vast majority of that, everybody agreed we wanted to protect. But we also made sure that there was room for grazing, for recreating, and for extraction in the appropriate places. And it's interesting you say, you know, how do we make this non-divisive? The reality of it is, even my Republican colleagues who don't live in the West have a hard time getting their arms around this. And they don't, you know, I'll hear my colleagues say, oh, I've got rural in my district. And I just laugh, right? Like, come on, you're in Connecticut.
Yeah, right.
Like rural, my standard of rural is you have to be able to drive 3 hours without seeing a structure. And then they'll say, oh, we have public lands. And they'll point to a park of 6 acres, right? And it's hard even to get Republicans to understand. So we have a group, it's called the Western Caucus. And our mission is to help people outside of the West really understand what it's like to have 90% of your land held by the federal government. Imagine that. Doesn't pay property taxes, pays a very small amount in payment in lieu of taxes, but it doesn't pay property tax. And you don't have the ability to say how it's going to be used. So imagine when somebody who has never been there and lives 2,000 miles away tries to dictate to you what you can do and can't do on that land. Of course, there's pushback. Of course, people are frustrated with that. What would you expect?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I have to step up on my personal soapbox here for just a moment, and we can have a chat. So one of the things that I am most frustrated about when, you know, the BLM or when the federal government, the White House, when they lock up public lands here in Utah, even if I fully support preserving and protecting that land for, say, outdoor recreation purposes, very seldom, if ever, do we see any resources coming from the federal government to maintain, protect, and provide access and information about these lands they lock up. And so I know we've had search and rescue and sheriffs from Wayne County, from Garfield County on KSL at night in past shows, and they're constantly worried about having the budget to go and rescue and save all these people who get lost in southeastern Utah because the federal government has put it on the map by protecting it. How do we get dollars from Congress to provide support for these lands?
So this is, I'm so glad, this is a critical question. And I see the same thing in Emory County and these other counties whose budgets are very small, spending millions of dollars on search and rescue and maintaining and taking care of these lands. So the answer to your question is, when an Antiquities Act is used or when a rule like this BLM rule is used, it brings zero resources to the area. So if you look at Bears Ears, for example, that where we've gone back and forth between the monument, the Presidential Antiquities Act designation has only highlighted this to the rest of the world, bringing people in, but brought no resources for signage, brought no resources for restrooms, brought no resources for search and rescue, brought no resources for preserving and protecting the antiquities that now people are you know, just running shot over because, you know, there's no signs or no education. When we put it through congressional legislation, we can bring resources. And this is why a huge reason why the Antiquities Act is a bad tool to preserve and protect. It should be done through congressional legislation because we can bring in the resources to take care of it. There's also something very important about congressional legislation. You're not going to get it through unless you have stakeholder consensus. That's not true with the Antiquities Act. You can have one president of one party roll this out with no consensus. But to get consensus with stakeholders means it's a lot of work, right? Yeah. You have to bring people in with different opinions. You have to bring ranchers in. You have to bring extraction. You have to bring environmentalists in and find consensus, which we did. And it can be done.
Absolutely.
But when people know that there's a shortcut, which is the Antiquities Act, they don't come into the table ready to talk. And this is a huge problem we have, is it takes all the motivation to work this out when you know, hey, we can just get a president to roll in with an Antiquities Act designation.
Yeah, absolutely. Congressman John Curtis, thank you so much for joining us here on KSL at Night. And thank you for all the work that you're doing on this very important issue. We wish you the best and look forward to having you back soon. Thank you.
Okay. Nice to you. Thanks.
Listeners, coming up next, we are going to have a conversation with the Deseret News' Brigham Tomko, who has covered Utah Governor Spencer Cox's Disagree Better on the TED Talk stage. After the break, stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. This is your host, Taylor Morgan. I want to welcome in to the show here in person, in studio, political reporter Brigham Tomko from the Deseret News. Brigham, I love your content. You do such a great job of getting to the heart of a story, but also covering all the nitty-gritty details, really informing us. I want to talk about your coverage of Spencer Cox's recent TED Talk in Vancouver. You wrote an excellent piece. Listeners, you can find this at Deseret.com. The headline is Utah Governor Spencer Cox Takes Disagree Better to the TED Talk Stage. Brigham, tell us about this talk. Did you watch it? Were you in Vancouver? Did you cover it remotely?
Well, thanks so much for having me. We were given exclusive online access to watch it live from here in the Deseret News newsroom. And this was a big deal for the governor. Utah's governor, Spencer Cox, over the last 6 or so months has been waging kind of a national campaign to spread this message of disagree better, teaching the nation's leaders and hopefully American voters as well how to have a healthier form of dialogue to kind of turn down the temperature. And this was the message that he brought to TED Talks yesterday as the only elected official there on stage.
The only elected official on the stage. How many TED Talks were given, do you know, at this conference?
Yeah, so there were about 80 speakers, and they included business leaders, artists, and academics, and he was the only sitting elected official to speak.
I think that's really significant. What was your sense of the response to his talk before we get into the talk itself?
The response was really warm and enthusiastic. There was a standing applause at the end of his remarks, and during the speech, he played a video that he actually recorded in 2020 with his opponent in the general election to run for governor, and that also got applause and shouts from the crowd. And so I think there was a warm reception for the governor there.
This is very interesting to me. I have not yet watched the TED Talk. I'm looking forward to doing that. I didn't get exclusive access through the Deseret News. So maybe we need to talk to someone about that, see if you can and help me out with that, Brigham.
We'll do it.
But I think, listeners and I, we're very familiar, I think. Anyone that covers Utah politics is no stranger to Governor Cox's message about disagree better. This is really something that is his brand. It's something that he ran on when he was first seeking the job as governor 4 years ago. It's really, I think, key to who he is and what he's done as governor. Why now, do you think, is he really getting so much attention outside of Utah for this Disagree Better campaign?
There's a couple of reasons. One of the main ones is since July of 2023, he has been the chair of the National Governors Association, which gives him a bigger platform and the opportunity to have a specific initiative that all of the governors in the country are supposed to kind of accompany him in promoting. And so governors across the country have joined him in producing these ads with kind of bipartisan pairings of elected officials. And another reason is because Governor Cox has gotten lots of attention for his work on social media and also finding kind of a Utah way or a middle path on contentious issues that has placed him in the pages of the New York Times and the Atlantic and things like this. And so he's kind of had a lot of headlines over the last several months.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because Governor Cox has taken some fairly, well, it could be argued that Governor Cox has taken some controversial, more, I don't want to say far right, but maybe more conservative positions on some hot topics recently, thinking of DEI, thinking of supporting the transgender bathroom bill that passed the legislature. He has really kind of been out ahead, right, of some of these more controversial issues. Yet throughout those debates, he has maintained this disagree better conversation. Now, I think his critics might try to say he's being disingenuous, but I think his whole point is actually really brought home by his taking positions, which could be seen as controversial by his opponents, yet throughout that process being respectful and engaging in constructive dialogue and debate. Does that track? Am I making sense? How do you see it?
Exactly. I don't think Governor Cox would say that disagreeing better means moderating one's policy stances or abandoning one's principles. But what it does mean, like you said, is throughout the process of legislating or negotiating or talking with people on the other side, that you are respectful and that you use civil dialogue and try to help other people understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. Compromise is not a dirty word. At the same time, disagree better doesn't imply compromise. It doesn't necessarily require moderation of positions. What it does is, I think, articulating your position and having a conversation in a respectful way. I think one of the quotes from his talk that I really appreciated was, quote, "You can't love your country if you hate half the people in it," end quote. I thought that was a really good point. It doesn't mean that, you know, we have to agree with each other or necessarily find the common ground. We can still speak to one another from our respective corners, but we can do that in a respectful way. Does that make sense? Is that his narrative, or is Governor Cox saying something different? Is he saying that we need to maybe come to the middle on some of these issues.
No, you hit the nail on the head. It has more to do with how we perceive the other side and less to do with our political ideology. And so at the end of his TED Talk, he said that this call to action that he's making is actually a call to love our enemies, kind of makes a reference to scripture there, and said if we really want to change the world, we have to start by changing our own hearts. And so he thinks that at the individual level, we can start to make a change in the, you know, the political environment in the country.
I think the political battle that has raged in this country from the very beginning between essentially what has always been this two-party system, these two fundamental, you know, perspectives or worldviews, that has always been a push and pull. It's always been a battle, right? I think what perhaps has changed more recently is the tone. And maybe rather the zero-sum approach, meaning that I only win when my opponent loses, right, and vice versa. But to wrap this up, Brigham, I want to really bring this home to Governor Cox's four steps. Can you walk us through those four steps that Governor Cox encouraged Americans to take in order to disagree better?
Absolutely. So Governor Cox argued that the political polarization in the country is more the product of media and politicians trying to pit us against each other and less the result of true differences between Republicans and Democrats or what have you. And so he said that to heal the divides in the country, we should spend less time with polarizing headlines that pit one side of the country against the other, like maybe on cable news or social media. And he recommends that we spend more time with people who think differently than us, ideally in person, you know, having conversations with them. And then also spending more time serving and giving back to society. And finally, attempting to develop the political virtues of humility, patience, and moderation.
Brigham, what do you think? Do you think this is good advice? I mean, as a political reporter, you probably hear all of this all the time. Just on a personal level, how did you feel about Governor Cox's talk? Is this real? Does he mean it? Is he being sincere? Or is this Disagree Better campaign just another campaign gimmick?
I'm not sure if it matters, because I think if more politicians talked this way, then automatically the rhetoric would be better and the way we perceive people on the other side of the aisle would start to shift as we use different kind of language to refer to our so-called political enemies.
Yeah, well, that is very well put. Brigham Tomko, a political reporter for the Deseret News, really appreciate you joining us in studio here at KSL at Night to walk us through Governor Cox's TED Talk. We'll have you back very soon. Thanks for all your great reporting, Brigham.
Well, thanks for having me.
Listeners, stay right here. Coming up next, we will have a conversation with Amanda Bollinger, candidate for the Utah State Board of Education. That's after the break.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. This is your host, Taylor Morgan. It is Thursday, April 18th. Listeners, I want to make sure you know that you can get breaking news updates directly sent to your mobile device simply by texting the word breaking to 57500. Again, you can sign up to receive breaking news alerts directly to your device simply by texting the word breaking to 57500. Well, with that said, very important news, not necessarily breaking right away, but broke on Saturday, this last Saturday, April 13th, at the Salt Lake County Convention. Delegates at the Republican Party Salt Lake County Convention eliminated state school board member, current incumbent Natalie Klein, and elected Amanda Bollinger. Republican challenger Amanda Bollinger received 63% of the delegate vote at the county convention on Saturday. Dr. Bollinger is now the Republican nominee and will go on to the general election in November. This was really a story that many were following very closely, given some of the scandal and the issues surrounding embattled state school board member Natalie Klein. We now want to move forward and focus on the nomination of Dr. Amanda Bollinger as the Republican candidate in this race. And we are so excited to be joined here on KSL at Night by Dr. Amanda Bollinger. Amanda, congratulations on your victory at convention. I imagine that you hopefully have had a little downtime the last few days, have caught up on some sleep.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. It has been a little bit of a whirlwind, and I have been trying to just catch up on sleep. That is a perfect way to say it.
Well, Amanda, what was your experience like leading up to convention, working with delegates and building support among current elected officials? Your campaign had a lot of support and a lot of momentum going into Saturday, but ultimately, we know that the decision was made by delegates. What was your experience like talking to them?
I used a group of great volunteers. I have a lot of friends and family that have been such a support to me. And so we worked really hard to host meet and greets virtually, in person, cottage meetings. We attended all of the GOP meet and greets and had booths at all of those locations. So we worked countless hours just connecting with all of the delegates to make sure that they knew about my platform, what I was about, my experience, my knowledge, and really what I feel like I could help bring to the state school board. So it was so amazing to hear their stories, what they're concerned about, and what they were hoping for in school board members. It was a great experience to connect with so many delegates.
Now, can you walk our listeners through exactly what a state school board member does? I know that that seems like a basic question, but the state school board has really, I think, garnered a lot of attention recently. We know that this became partisan in terms of electing members of the state school board fairly recently. Can you walk us through what the job will be if you do win election in November?
Sure. So the state school board, they meet twice a month. One day they meet in a full meeting where they also connect with public, and there's public comment, and there's different things they have on their agenda. And then the second day of the month, they break out into smaller committee meetings. And really the role of the school board is to help take federal law and state law, put that into guidelines for schools and school districts so they know how to apply laws into schools. And then the other big pieces that the state school board helps oversee is teacher licensing laws and what it takes to become a teacher here in Utah, and then also the standards that are taught, so the curriculum standards that schools then are supposed to follow. So those are the three big roles of the state school board.
I really appreciated what you said on Saturday at convention. I was a county delegate. I'm in a different school board, unfortunately, but I did pay attention to what you said on Saturday. And this particular quote really was impressive to me. You said, "In these challenging times, we need to unify and not divide. I am a leader that can help bring people together, and I will work tirelessly to bridge the gaps between stakeholders." Can you explain what are the gaps? Where are these issues where we need to bring people together as a member of the state school board?
Yeah, so I think that is at all levels. So it's from parents to schools, school leaders to the state school board, and then the school board to legislators. And oftentimes there's either misunderstandings or unintended consequences when decisions are made. So for example, there might be a law the legislators make because it sounds like a good idea that somebody brings to them, but it may not have the full picture of how it would impact principals and teachers and school leaders. And then same vice versa, right? If you might have a parent that's concerned about something and they hear something, but it may not be the truth of what's really happening in the schools. So being able to really be that bridge, because of my experience, my ability to work with all levels, I think that that's something that I bring, that perspective of what it's like to work with parents and teachers and school administrators and district administrators and state school board, and then also legislators.
Now, we don't need to get into the details and rehash the scandal involving your convention opponent. As we move ahead, though, how do we heal? And how, as a potential new member of the state school board, if you win in November, how do you move forward with the community to repair and to heal some of the, you know, the harm that has been done there?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we focus on putting the trust of our education system back into how we function here in Utah and make sure parents do trust what we're doing in our schools. And part of that is transparency and making sure that they feel like they have a say. It is important that we're partnering with parents and that we're being open about what's happening in schools, and we invite parents to come into schools. I think that's a big piece of it. I also think it's important to make sure that we are communicating what's happening and why things are happening, because if people don't know all of the parts and pieces, they often fill in the blanks for themselves. And being able to effectively communicating what's happening and why it's happening with policy or law is really important to make sure that people are confident that we're making the best decisions for kids.
Yeah, definitely. Not to put you on the hot seat, and this is maybe more of just a conversational question that I keep coming back to in my own head, but do we think it's a good thing that our state school board members are elected through the partisan process? Previously, it was a nonpartisan office. Do you think there's positives of having it be a partisan race now, or potential drawbacks?
I think it has both. And I've had this conversation with some of our current legislators recently, and they feel like when you're going to vote for somebody for a position, you often want to vote for somebody that has your same values and beliefs. And they believe that by being associated with a specific political party, it helps individuals know whether or not they align with their basic beliefs. The unintended consequence of that is that often if people make decisions based off of political agendas versus what's best for kids, then our kids are the ones that suffer. So there's pros and cons to both.
Yeah, well, I will say, at least in my opinion, I think your race for State School Board District 9 is clearly an example of, well, it worked and delegates got it right. In the past, maybe, again, my own opinion, delegates in the parties haven't always gotten it right. Their values haven't necessarily always aligned with the broader voters in the parties. However, in your particular race, boy, I have to really tip my hat to the delegates. I thought they did their work and they vetted the candidates. And again, in my opinion, I think they got it right. So congratulations to you on your win at convention and being the Republican nominee for State School Board District 9. And best wishes to you for November. I'm sure we'll have you back well before then.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Looking forward to watching that race as we go into November. Listeners, great show this evening. Thanks so much for tuning in. Tune in again tomorrow, Friday night, for another episode of KSL at Night.